old stories line the shelves of our dusty archives. Stories of dreams, mystery, horror. We would like to bring one of our early radio tales back to life during this half hour. Let's see. Ah, here's a whole alcove devoted to Edgar Allan Poe. And in a section marked Old Men. Two stories. One about an old man who just couldn't keep quiet. The other old man just couldn't be reached. Let's hear about him first in The Man of the Crowd.
There are some secrets which do not permit themselves to be told. Men die nightly in their beds, wringing the hands of ghostly confessors and looking them piteously in the eyes. Die of despair of heart and convulsion of throat on account of the hideousness of mysteries which will not suffer themselves to be revealed. Now and then, alas, the conscience of man takes up a burden so heavy in horror that it can be thrown down only into the grave. And thus, the essence of all crime is undivulged. Not long ago, about the closing in of an evening in autumn, I sat at the large bay window of a coffee house in London, peering through the smoky panes into the street, one of the principal thoroughfares of the city. As the darkness came on, the throng momentarily increased. Two dense and continuous tides of population were rushing past the door. At first, I looked at the passengers in masses. Soon, however, I descended to details and regarded with minute interest the innumerable varieties. The greater number had a satisfied, business-like demeanor, others restless, talking to themselves. The tribe of clerks, one breed wearing the cast-off graces of the gentry, another, the affectation of respectability. Descending the scale of what is termed gentility, darker and deeper themes, beggars, ghastly and feeble invalids, drunkards. As the night deepened, the late hour brought forth every species of infamy from its den, and deepened in me also the interest of the scene. With my brow to the glass, I was thus occupied in scrutinizing the mob, when suddenly there came into view a countenance, that of a decrepit old man, some 65 or 70 years of age, a countenance which at once arrested and absorbed my whole attention. There arose within my mind the ideas of vast mental power, of caution, of penuriousness, of avarice, coolness, malice, of bloodthirstiness, of triumph, of merriment, of excess terror, of intense, of extreme despair. I felt singularly aroused and fascinated. Then came a craving desire to keep the man in view, to know more of him. I made my way into the street and pushed through the crowd in the direction which I had seen him take. I had never come up within sight of him, approached and followed him closely, yet cautiously, so as not to attract his attention. He was short in stature, very thin, and apparently very feeble. His clothes generally were filthy and ragged. It was now fully nightfall, and the humid fog had ended in a settled, heavy rain. For half an hour, the old man held his way with difficulty along the great thoroughfare, and I walked close at his elbow through fear of losing sight of him. Never once turning his head to look back, he didn't observe me. By and by, he passed into a cross street. Not quite so much thronged as the one he quitted. He walked more slowly, more hesitatingly. He crossed and recrossed the way repeatedly without apparent aim. The street was a narrow and long one, and his course lay within it for nearly an hour, during which the passengers had gradually diminished. A turn brought us into a square, brilliantly lighted and overflowing with life. He urged his way steadily and perseveringly. I was surprised, however, to find, upon his having made the circuit of the square,
that he turned and retraced his steps, repeating the same walk several times, once nearly detecting me as he came round with a sudden movement. In this exercise, he spent another hour. The rain fell fast, the air grew cool, and the people were retiring to their homes. With a gesture of impatience, the wanderer passed into a by-street comparatively deserted. And down this, some quarter of a mile long, he rushed with an activity I couldn't have dreamed of seeing in one so aged. A few moments later brought us into a large and busy bazaar, and he forced his way to and fro without aim among the host of buyers and sellers. At no moment did he see me that I watched him. He entered shop after shop, priced nothing, spoke no word, looked at all objects with a wild and vacant stare. I was now utterly amazed at his behavior. Excuse me. I was resolved to follow him wherever he went, and that we should not part until I had satisfied myself in some measure respecting him. By 11 o'clock, the company were fast deserting the bazaar. A shopkeeper, in putting up a shutter, jostled the old man. He shuddered and hurried into the street, looked anxiously around him for an instant, and then ran with incredible swiftness through many crooked and peopled lanes, until we emerged once more upon the great thoroughfare whence we had started. It was still brilliant with gas, but the rain fell fiercely, and there were few persons to be seen. The stranger grew pale. He walked moodily. Then with a heavy sigh, turned in the direction of the river, and plunging through a great variety of devious ways, came out at length in view of one of the principal theatres. The audience were thronging from the doors. The old man gasped as if for breath and threw himself into the crowd. Eventually the company grew more scattered, and his old uneasiness and vacillation were resumed. For some time, he followed closely a party of some 10 or 12 roisterers. But one by one, they dropped off. In a narrow and gloomy lane, the stranger paused, and for a moment seemed lost in thought. And then, with every mark of agitation, pursued rapidly a route which brought us to the most noisome quarter of London. Everything wore the worst impress of the most deplorable poverty and crime. Tall, antique, worm-eaten, wooden tenements, horrible, filthy, festered in the dammed-up gutters. The whole atmosphere teemed with desolation. Yet, as we proceeded, the sounds of human life revived. Large bands of the most abandoned London populace were seen reeling to and fro. The spirits of the old man again flickered up, as a lamp which is near its death's hour. Once more he strode onward. Suddenly a corner was turned. A blaze of light burst upon our sight, and we stood before one of the huge suburban temples of intemperance. It was now nearly daybreak, but a number of wretched inebriates were still pressing in and out. With half a shriek of joy, the old man forced a passage within. He stalked backward and forward, without apparent object, among the throng. When finally they were gone, it was something even more intense than despair that I then observed. Yet he didn't hesitate, but with a mad energy, he retraced his steps at once to the heart of the mighty London. Long and swiftly he fled, while I followed him in the wildest amazement, resolute not to abandon the scrutiny in which I now felt an interest all-absorbing. The sun rose while we proceeded, and when we had reached the most thronged part of the populous town, it presented an appearance of human bustle and activity scarcely inferior to what I had seen on the evening before. And here, long among the increasing confusion, did I persist in my pursuit of the stranger. But, as usual, he walked to and fro, and during the day didn't pass out from the turmoil of the street. As the shades of the second evening passed on, I grew wearied unto death. And stopping full in front of the wanderer, gazed at him steadfastly in the face. He noticed me not,
but resumed his solemn walk. This old man is the type and genius of deep crime. He refuses to be alone. He's the man of the crowd. It will be in vain to follow. I shall learn no more of him, nor of his deeds. For he doesn't permit himself to be ruined.
Bernard Mays told us Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Man of the Crowd, with technical production by John Whiting. We're going to meet another character now, also invented by Edgar Allan Poe. He has his troubles with an old man who won't allow himself to be silenced. It's the Telltale Heart.
Nervous, very, very dreadfully nervous I had been and am. But why will you say that I am mad? The disease had sharpened my senses, not destroyed, not dulled them. Above all was the sense of hearing acute. I heard all things in the heaven and in the earth. I heard many things in hell. How then am I mad? Hearken, and observe how healthily, how calmly I can tell you the whole story. It is impossible to say how first the idea entered my brain, but once conceived, it haunted me day and night. Object there was none, passion there was none. I loved the old man. He had never wronged me. He had never given me insult. For his gold, I had no desire. I think it was his eye. Yes. It was this one of his eyes that resembled that of a vulture, a pale blue eye with a film over it. Whenever it fell upon me, my blood ran cold. And so by degrees, very gradually, I made up my mind to take the life of the old man and thus rid myself of the eye forever. Now, this is the point. You fancy me mad. Madmen know nothing, but you should have seen me. You should have seen how wisely I proceeded, with what caution, with what foresight, with what dissimulation I went to work. I was never kinder to the old man than during the whole week before I killed him. And every night, about midnight, I turned the latch of his door and opened it, oh, so gently. And then, when I had made an opening sufficient for my head, I put in a dark lantern, all closed. Closed so that no light shone out. And then I thrust in my head. Oh, you would have laughed to see how cunningly I thrust it in. I moved it slowly, very, very slowly, so that I might not disturb the old man's sleep. It took me an hour to place my whole head within the opening so far that I could see him as he lay upon his bed. Would a madman have been so wise as this? And then, when my head was well in the room, I undid the lantern cautiously, oh, so cautiously. Cautiously, the hinges creaked. I undid it just so much that a single thin ray fell upon the vulture eye. And this I did for 7 long nights, every night just at midnight. But I found the eye always closed. And so it was impossible to do the work. But it was not the old man who vexed me, but his evil eye. And every morning when the day broke, I went boldly into the chamber and spoke courageously to him, calling him by name in a hearty tone and inquiring how he had passed the night. So you see, he would have been a very profound old man indeed to suspect that every night just at 12 I looked in upon him while he slept. On the eighth night, I was more than usually cautious in opening the door. A watcher's minute hand moves more quickly than did mine. Never before that night had I felt the extent of my own powers, of my sagacity. I could scarcely contain my feelings of triumph to think that there I was, opening the door little by little, and he not even to dream of my secret deeds or thoughts. I fairly chuckled at the idea. And perhaps he heard me, for he moved on the bed suddenly as if startled. Now you may think that I drew back, but no. His room was as black as pitch with the thick darkness. The shutters were close fastened through fear of robbers. And so I knew that he could not see the opening of the door. And I kept pushing it on steadily, steadily. I had my head in and was about to open the lantern when my thumb slipped upon the tin fastening and the old man sprang up in the bed crying out,
"Who's there?"
I kept quite still and said nothing. For a whole hour, I did not move a muscle. And in the meantime, I did not hear him lie down. He was still sitting up in the bed, listening, just as I have done night after night, hearkening to the death watches in the wall. Presently, I heard a slight groan, and I knew it was the groan of mortal terror. It was not a groan of pain or of grief, oh no. It was the low, stifled sound that arises from the bottom of the soul when overcharged with awe. I knew the sound well. Many a night, just at midnight when all the world slept, it had welled up from my own bosom, deepening with its dreadful echo the terrors that distracted me. I say I knew it well. I knew what the old man felt and pitied him, although I chuckled at heart. I knew that he had been lying awake ever since the first slight noise when he had turned in the bed. His fears had been ever since growing upon him. He had been trying to fancy them causeless, but could not. He had been saying to himself, "It is nothing but the wind in the chimney. It is only a mouse crossing the floor, or it is merely a cricket which has made a single chirp." Yes, he has been trying to comfort himself with these suppositions, but he had found all in vain, because death in approaching him had stalked with his black shadow before him and enveloped the victim. And it was the mournful influence of the unperceived shadow that caused him to feel, although he neither saw nor heard, to feel the presence of my head within the room. When I had waited a long time, very patiently, without hearing him lie down, I resolved to open a very, very little crevice in the lantern. So I opened it. You cannot imagine how stealthily, until at length a single dim ray, like the thread of the spider, shot from out the crevice and fell upon the vulture eye. It was open, wide, wide open, and I grew furious as I gazed upon it. I saw it with perfect distinctness, all a dull blue with a hideous veil over it that chilled the very marrow in my bones. But I could see nothing else of the old man's face or person, for I had directed the ray as if by instinct precisely upon the damned spot. And now, have I not told you that what you mistake for madness is but over-acuteness of the senses? Now, I say, there came to my ears a low, dull, quick sound, such as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I knew that sound well, too. It was the beating of the old man's heart. It increased my fury as the beating of a drum stimulates the soldier into courage. But even yet I refrained and kept still. I scarcely breathed. I held the lantern motionless. I tried how steadily I could maintain the ray upon the eye. Meanwhile, the hellish tattoo of the heart increased. It grew quicker and quicker and louder every instant. Oh, the old man's terror must have been extreme. It grew louder, I say, louder every moment. Do you mock me? Well, I have told you that I am nervous, so I am. And now at the dead hour of the night, amid the dreadful silence of that old house, so strange a noise as this excited me to uncontrollable terror. Yet, for some minutes longer, I refrained and stood still. But The beating grew louder, louder. I thought the heart must burst. And now, a new anxiety seized me. The sound would be heard by a neighbor. Oh, the old man's hour had come. With a loud yell, I threw open the lantern and leaped into the room. He shrieked once. Once only. In an instant, I dragged him to the floor and pulled the heavy bed over him. I then smiled gaily to find the deed so far done. But for many minutes, the heart beat on with a muffled sound. This, however, did not vex me. It would not be heard through the wall. At length, it ceased. The old man was dead. I removed the bed and examined the corpse. Yes, he was stone dead. I placed my hand upon the heart and held it there many minutes. There was no pulsation. He was stone dead. His eye would trouble me no more. If still you think me mad, you will think so no longer when I describe the wise precautions I took for the concealment of the body. The night waned, and I worked hastily, but in silence. First of all, I dismembered the corpse. I cut off the head and the arms and the legs. I then took up three planks from the flooring of the chamber and deposited all between the scantlings. I then replaced the board so cleverly, so cunningly, that no human eye, not even his, could have detected anything wrong. There was nothing to wash out, no stain of any kind, no blood spot, whatever. I had been too wary for that. A tub had caught all. When I had made an end of these labors, it was 4 o'clock, still dark as midnight. As the bell sounded the hour, there came a knocking at the street door. I went down to open it with a light heart, for what had I now to fear? There entered 3 men who introduced themselves with perfect suavity as officers of the police. A shriek had been heard by a neighbor during the night. Suspicion of foul play had been aroused. Information had been lodged at the police office, and they, the officers, had been deputed to search the premises. I smiled, for what had I to fear? I bade the gentlemen welcome. The shriek, I said, was my own in a dream. The old man, I mentioned, was absent in the country. I took my visitors all over the house. I bade them search, search well. I led them at length to his chamber. I showed them his treasures secure, undisturbed. In the enthusiasm of my confidence, I brought chairs into the room and desired them here to rest from their fatigues, while I myself, in the wild audacity of my perfect triumph, placed my own seat upon the very spot beneath which reposed the corpse of the victim. The officers were satisfied. My manner had convinced them. I was singularly at ease. They sat, and while I answered cheerily, they chatted of familiar things. But ere long, I felt myself getting pale and wished them gone. My head ached, and I fancied a ringing in my ears. But still they sat and still chatted. The ringing became more distinct. It continued to become more distinct. I talked more freely to get rid of the feeling, but it continued and gained definitiveness until at length I found that the noise was not within my ears. No doubt I now grew very pale, but I talked more fluently and with a heightened voice. Yet the sound increased, and what could I do? It was a low, dull, quick sound, much such a sound as a watch makes when enveloped in cotton. I gasped for breath, and yet the officers heard it not. I talked more quickly, more vehemently, but the noise steadily increased. I arose and argued about trifles in a high key and with violent gesticulations, but the noise steadily increased. Why would they not be gone? I paced the floor to and fro with heavy strides, as if excited to fury by the observations of the men, but the noise steadily increased. Oh, God, what could I do? I foamed, I raved, I swore. I swung the chair upon which I'd been sitting and grated it upon the boards, but the noise arose over all and continually increased. It grew louder, louder, louder. And still the men chatted pleasantly and smiled. Was it possible they heard not? Almighty God, no, no, they heard, they suspected, they knew. They were making a mockery of my horror, as I thought, and this I think. But anything was better than this agony, anything was more tolerable than this derision, I could bear those hypocritical smiles no longer. I felt that I must scream or die. And now again, hark, louder, 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 louder! Villains! Dissemble no more, I admit the deed! Tear up the planks! Here! 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 It is the beating of his hideous heart. True, nervous. Very, very dreadfully nervous. I had been. And am. But why will you say that I am mad?
The Telltale Heart by Edgar Allan Poe, performed by Eric Bauersfeld, with technical production by Jim McKee. Most of the tales on this series were produced for radio over two decades ago. This one is more recent. Well, that's all for now. Come and visit our archives again for another tale from the shadows. Real soon.